Chapter 3. In the spring of 1869, David van Veen, a wealthy architect of Flemish extraction, in no way related to the Veens of our rambling romance, escaped uninjured when the motor car he was driving from Cannes to Calais blew a front tire on a frost-glazed road and tore into a parked furniture van. His daughter, sitting beside him, was instantly killed by a suitcase sailing into her from behind and breaking her neck. In his London studio, her husband, an unbalanced, unsuccessful painter, 10 years older than his father-in-law, whom he envied and despised, shot himself upon receiving the news by cablegram from a village in Normandy called, dreadfully, Daye. The moment of disaster lost none of its speed, for neither did Eric, a boy of 15, despite all the care and adoration which his grandfather surrounded him with, escape a freakish fate, a fate strangely similar to his mother's. After being removed from Note to a small private school in Vaux Canton, and then spending a consumptive summer in the Maritime Alps, he was sent to Aix-en-Valais, whose crystal air was supposed at the time to strengthen young lungs, instead of which its worst hurricane hurled a roof tile at him, fatally fracturing his skull. Among the boy's belongings, David van Veen found a number of poems and the draft of an essay entitled Villa Venus, An Organized Dream. To put it bluntly, the boy had sought to solace his first sexual torments by imagining and detailing a project derived from reading too many erotic works found in a furnished house his grandfather had bought near Vence from Count Tolstoy, a Russian or Pole, namely a chain of palatial brothels that his inheritance would allow him to establish all over both hemispheres of our Calipigian globe. The little chap saw it as a kind of fashionable club with branches, or in his poetical phrase, florimores, in the vicinity of cities and spas. Membership was to be restricted to noblemen, handsome and healthy, with an age limit of 50, which must be praised as very broad-minded on the poor kid's part, paying a yearly fee of 3,650 guineas, not counting the cost of bouquets, jewels, and other gallant donations. Resident female physicians, good-looking and young, of the American secretarial or dentist assistant type, would be there to check the intimate physical condition of the caresser and the caressed, another felicitous formula, as well as their own if the need arose. One clause in the rules of the club seemed to indicate that Eric, though frenziedly heterosexual, had enjoyed some tender ersatz fumblings with schoolmates at Note, a notorious preparatory school in that respect.
This is the end of disc number 10. Please insert disc number 11. This is disc number 11.
One clause in the rules of the club seemed to indicate that Eric, though frenziedly heterosexual, had enjoyed some tender ersatz fumblings with schoolmates at Note, a notorious preparatory school in that respect. At least two of the maximum number of 50 inmates in the major florimores might be pretty boys, wearing frontlets and short smocks, not older than 14 if fair, and not more than 12 if dark. However, in order to exclude a regular flow of inveterate pederasts, boy love could be dabbled in by the jaded guest only between two sequences of three girls each, all possessed in the course of the same week, a somewhat comical but not unshrewd stipulation. The candidates for every florimore were to be selected by a committee of club members who would take into consideration the annual accumulation of impressions and desiderata jotted down by the guests in a special shell-pink book. Beauty and tenderness, grace and docility composed the main qualities required of the girls, aged from 15 to 25, in the case of slender Nordic dolls, and from 10 to 20, and that of opulent Southern charmers. They would gamble and loll in boudoirs and conservatories, invariably naked and ready for love. Not so their attendants. Attractively dressed handmaids of more or less exotic extraction, unavailable to the fancy of members except by special permission from the board. My favorite clause, for I own a photostat of that poor boy's calligraph, is that any girl in her Florimore could be lady-in-chief by acclamation during her menstrual period. This, of course, did not work, and the committee compromised by having a good-looking female homosexual head the staff and adding a bouncer whom Eric had overlooked. Eccentricity is the greatest grief's greatest remedy. The boy's grandfather set it once to render in brick and stone, concrete and marble, flesh and fun, Eric's fantasy. He resolved to be the first sampler of the first houri he would hire for his last house, and to live until then in laborious abstinence. It must have been a moving and magnificent sight, that of the old but still vigorous Dutchman with his rugged reptilian face and white hair, designing with the assistance of leftist decorators the 1,001 memorial Florimores he resolved to erect all over the world, perhaps even in brutal Tartary, which he thought was ruled by Americanized Jews. But then, art redeemed politics, profoundly original concepts that we must condone in a lovable old crank. He began with rural England and coastal America, and was engaged in a Robert Adam-like composition, cruelly referred to by local wags as the Madam I'm Adam House, not far from Newport, Rhodos Island, in a somewhat senile style, with marble columns dredged from classical seas and still encrusted with Etruscan oyster shells, when he died from a stroke while helping to prop up a propylon. It was only his 100th house. His nephew and heir, an honest but astoundingly stuffy clothier in Ruinen, somewhere near Svola, I'm told, with a large family and a small trade, was not cheated out of the millions of guldens about the apparent squandering of which he had been consulting mental specialists during the last 10 years or so. All the 100 Florimores opened simultaneously on September 20th, 1875, and by a delicious coincidence, the old Russian word for September, Ryuin, which might have been spelled R-U-I-N, also echoed the name of the ecstatic Neverlander's hometown. By the beginning of the new century, the Venus revenues were pouring in, their final gush, it is true. A tattling tabloid reported, around 1890, that out of gratitude and curiosity, Velvet Veen traveled once, and only once, to the nearest Florimore with his entire family. And it is also said that Guillaume de Montparnasse indignantly rejected an offer from Hollywood to base a screenplay on that dignified and hilarious excursion. Mere rumors, no doubt. Eric's grandfather's range was wide, from Dodo to Dada, from Low Gothic to Hoch Modern. In his parodies of paradise, he even permitted himself just a few times to express the rectilinear chaos of cubism with abstract cast in concrete by imitating in the sense described so well in Vollner's paperback History of English Architecture, given me by good Dr. Lagos. Such ultra-utilitarian boxes of brick as the Maison Close of Elfroid in Lubertkin, Austria, or the great necessity houses of Dudok in Friesland. But on the whole, it was the idyllic and the romantic that he favored. English gentlemen of parts found many pleasures in Letchworth Lodge, an honest country house plastered up to its bull eyes, or Itchnor Chat with its battered chimney breasts and hipped gables. None could help admiring David von Veen's knack of making his brand new Regency mansion look like a renovated farmhouse, or of producing a converted convent on a small offshore island with such miraculous effect that one could not distinguish the arabesque from the arbutus, ardor from art, the sore from the rose. We shall always remember Little Lemantry near Rantchester, or the pseudotherm in the lovely cul-de-sac south of the viaduct of fabulous Palermontovia. We appreciated greatly his blending local banality, that chateau girdled with chestnuts, that castello guarded by cypresses, with interior ornaments that pandered to all the orgies reflected in the ceiling mirrors of little Eric's erogenetics. Most effective in a functional sense was the protection the architect distilled, as it were, from the ambitus of his houses. Whether nestling in woodland dells or surrounded by a many-acred park, or overlooking terraced groves and gardens, access to Venus began by a private road and continued through a labyrinth of hedges and walls with inconspicuous doors to which only the guests and the guards had keys. Cunningly distributed spotlights followed the wandering of the masked and caped grandees through dark mazes of coppices. For one of the stipulations imagined by Eric was that every establishment should be open only at nightfall and close at sunrise. A system of bells that Eric may have thought up all by himself. It was really as old as the Bauta and the Vishibala, prevented visitors from running into each other on the premises, so that no matter how many noblemen were waiting or wenching in any part of the Florimoor, each felt he was the only cock in the coop, because the bouncer, a silent and courteous person resembling a Manhattan shopwalker, did not count, of course. You sometimes saw him when a hitch occurred in connection with your credentials or credit, but he was seldom obliged to apply vulgar force or call in an assistant. According to Eric's plan, councils of elderly noblemen were responsible for mustering the girls. Delicately fashioned phalanges, good teeth, a flawless epiderm, undyed hair, impeccable buttocks and breasts, and the unfeigned vim of avid venery were the absolute prerequisites demanded by the elders, as they had been by Eric. Intactas were tolerated only if very young. On the other hand, no woman who had ever borne a child, even in her own childhood, could be accepted, no matter how free she was of mammillary blemishes. Their social rank had been left unspecified, but the committees were inclined, initially and theoretically, to recruit girls of more or less gentle birth. Daughters of artists were preferred, on the whole, to those of artisans. Quite an unexpected number turned out to be the children of peeved peers in cold castles or of ruined baronesses in shabby hotels. In a list of about 2,000 females working in all the Florimoors on January the 1st, 1890, the greatest year in the annals of Villa Venice, I counted as many as 22 directly connected with the royal families of Europe, but at least one quarter of all the girls belonged to plebeian groups. Owing to some nice vstryaska, shake-up, in the genetic kaleidoscope, or mere poker luck, or no reason at all, the daughters of peasants and peddlers and plumbers were not seldom more stylish than their middle-middle-class or upper-upper-class companions, a curious point that will please my non-gentle readers no less than the fact that the servant girls below the Oriental charmers, who assisted in various rituals of silver basins, embroidered towels, and dead-end smiles, the client and his clickies, not seldom descended from emblazoned princely heights. Damon's father, and very soon Damon himself, and Lord Ermanin, and a Mr. Ritkoff, and Count Peter de Pré, and Mir de Mir Esquire, and Baron Azzurroscudo, were all members of the first Venus Club Council, but it was bashful, obese, big-nosed Mr. Ritkoff's visits that really thrilled the girls and filled the vicinity with detectives who dutifully impersonated hedge-cutters, grooms, horses, tall milkmaids, new statues, old drunks, and so forth, while His Majesty dallied in a special chair built for his weight and whims with this or that sweet subject of the realm, white, black, or brown. Because the particular Florimoor that I visited for the first time on becoming a member of the Villa Venus Club, not long before my second summer with my Ada in the arbors of Ardis, is today, after many vicissitudes, the charming country house of a chose don whom I respect, and his charming family, a charming wife and a triplet of charming 12-year-old daughters, Ala, Lola, and Lalage. especially Lalage. I cannot name it, though my dearest reader insists I have mentioned it somewhere before. I had frequented bordels since my 16th year, but although some of the better ones, especially in France and Ireland, rated a triple red symbol in Nug's guidebook, nothing about them pre-announced the luxury and mollitude of my first Villa Venice. It was the difference between a den and an Eden. Three Egyptian squaws, dutifully keeping in profile, long ebony eye, lovely snub, braided black mane, honey-hued faro frock, thin amber arms, negro bangles, donut earring of gold bisected by a pleat of the mane, red Indian hairband, ornamental bib, lovingly borrowed by Eric Veen from a reproduction of a Theban fresco, no doubt pretty banal in 1420 BC, printed in Germany, Künstler Postkarte, number 6034, says cynical Dr. Lagosse, prepared me by means of what parched Eric called exquisite manipulations of certain nerves whose position and power are known only to a few ancient sexologists, accompanied by the no less exquisite application of certain ointments, not too specifically mentioned in the porno lore of Eric's Orientalia, for receiving a scared little virgin, the descendant of an Irish king, as Eric was told in his last dream in ex-Switzerland, by a master of funerary rather than fornicatory ceremonies. Those preparations proceeded in such sustained, unendurably delicious rhythms that Eric, dying in his sleep, and Vaughn, throbbing with foul life on a rococo couch 3 miles south of Bedford, could not imagine how those three young ladies, now suddenly divested of their clothes, a well-known onerotic device, could manage to draw out a prelude that kept one so long on the very lip of its resolution. I lay supine and felt twice the size I had ever been. Senescent nonsense, says science. When finally six gentle hands attempted to ease Lagosse, trembling Adada upon the terrible tool. Silly pity, a sentiment I rarely experience, caused my desire to droop, and I had her carried away to a feast of peach tarts and cream. The Egyptians looked disconcerted, but very soon perked up. I summoned all the 20 hirens of the house, including the sweet-lipped, glossy-chinned darling, into my resurrected presence. After considerable examination, after much flattering of haunches and necks, I chose a golden Gretchen, a pale Andalusian, and a black belle from New Orleans. The handmaids pounced upon them like pards, and, having empazoned them with not unlesbian zest, turned the three rather melancholy graces over to me. The towel given me to wipe off the sweat that filmed my face and stung my eyes could have been cleaner. I raised my voice. I had the reluctant, accursed casement wrenched wide open. A lorry had got stuck in the mud of a forbidden and unfinished road, and its groans and exertions dissipated the bizarre gloom. Only one of the girls stung me right in the soul, but I went through all three of them grimly and leisurely, changing mounts in midstream. Eric's advice, before ending every time in the grip of the ardent Andalusian, who said as we parted after one last spasm, although non-erotic chit-chat was against the rules, that her father had constructed the swimming pool on the estate of Demon Veen's cousin. It was now all over. The lorry had gone or had drowned, and Eric was a skeleton in the most expensive corner of the ex-cemetery. But then all cemeteries are ex, remarked a jovial Protestant priest, between an anonymous alpinist and my stillborn double. Cherry, the only lad in our next American Floramore, a little Salopian of 11 or 12, looked so amusing with his copper curls, dreamy eyes, and elfin cheekbones, the two exceptionally sportive courtesans, entertaining Vaughn, prevailed upon him one night to try the boy. Their joint efforts failed, however, to arouse the pretty catamite, who had been exhausted by too many recent engagements. His girlish crupper proved sadly defaced by the varicolored imprints of bestial clawings and flesh twistings, but worst of all, the little fellow could not disguise a state of acute indigestion, marked by unappetizing dysenteric symptoms that coated his lover's shaft with mustard and blood, the result, no doubt, of eating too many green apples. Eventually, he had to be destroyed or given away. Generally speaking, the adjunction of boys had to be discontinued. A famous French Florimore was never the same after the Earl of Langburn discovered his kidnapped son, a green-eyed, frail fawnlet, being examined by a veterinary whom the Earl shot dead by mistake. In 1905, a glancing blow was dealt Villa Venice from another quarter. The personage we have called Ritkoff, or Vrotic, had been induced by the ailings of age to withdraw his patronage. However, one night he suddenly arrived, looking again as ruddy as the proverbial fiddle, but after the entire staff of his favorite Florimore near Bath had worked in vain on him till an ironic Hesperus rose in a milkman's humdrum sky, the wretched sovereign of one half of the globe called for the Shell Pink Book, wrote in it a line that Seneca had once composed, "Subsidunt montes et yuga celsa ruunt," and departed, weeping. About the same time, a respectable lesbian, who conducted a Villa Venice at Souvenir, the beautiful Missouri spa, throttled with her own hands, she had been a Russian weightlifter, two of her most beautiful and valuable charges. It was all rather sad. When the deterioration of the club set in, it proceeded with amazing rapidity along several unconnected lines. Girls of flawless pedigree turned out to be wanted by the police as the molls of bandits with grotesque jaws, or to have been criminals themselves. Corrupt physicians passed faded blondes who have had half a dozen children, some of them being already prepared to enter remote Florimores themselves. Cosmeticians of genius restored 40-year-old matrons to look and smell like schoolgirls at their first prom. High-born gentlemen, magistrates of radiant integrity, mild-mannered scholars, proved to be such violent copulators that some of their younger victims had to be hospitalized and removed to ordinary lupanars. The anonymous protectors of courtesans brought medical inspectors, and the Raja of Kachu, an impostor, was infected with the venereal disease by a genuine great-grandniece of Empress Josephine. Simultaneously, economic disasters, beyond the financial or philosophical ken of invulnerable Van and Demon, but affecting many persons of their set, began to restrict the aesthetic assets of Villa Venice. Disgusting pimps with obsequious grins disclosing gaps in their tawny teeth popped out of rose bushes with illustrated pamphlets, and there were fires and earthquakes, and quite suddenly, out of the 100 original palazzos, only a dozen remained. And even those soon sank to the level of stagnant stews. And by 1910, all the dead of the English cemetery at X had to be transferred to a common grave. Vaughn never regretted his last visit to one last Villa Venice. A cauliflowered candle was messily burning in its tin cup on the window ledge next to the guitar-shaped, paper-wrapped bunch of long roses for which nobody had troubled to find or could have found a vase. On a bed some way off lay a pregnant woman, smoking, looking up at the smoke mingling its volutes with the shadows on the ceiling, one knee raised, one hand dreamily scratching her brown groin. Far beyond her, a door standing ajar gave on what appeared to be a moonlit gallery, but was really an abandoned, half-demolished, vast reception room with a broken outer wall, zigzag fissures in the floor, and the black ghost of a gaping grand piano, emitting, as if all by itself, spooky glissando twangs in the middle of the night. Through a great rip in the marbleized brick and plaster, the naked sea, not seen but heard as a panting space separated from time, dully boomed. Dully withdrew its platter of pebbles, and with the crumbling sounds, indolent gusts of warm wind reached the unwalled rooms, disturbing the volutes of shadow above the woman, and a bit of dirty fluff that had drifted down onto her pale belly, and even the reflection of the candle in a cracked pane of the bluish casement. Beneath it, on a rump-tickling coarse couch, Vaughn reclined, pouting pensively, pensively caressing the pretty head on his chest, flooded by the black hair of a much younger sister or cousin of the wretched Florinda on the tumbled bed. The child's eyes were closed, and whenever he kissed their moist convex lids, the rhythmic motion of her blind breasts changed or stopped altogether, and was presently resumed. He was thirsty, but the champagne he had brought with the softly rustling roses remained sealed, and he had not the heart to remove the silky deer head from his breast so as to begin working on the explosive bottle. He had fondled and fouled her many times in the course of the last 10 days, but was not sure if her name was really Adora, as everybody maintained. She and the other girl and a third one, a maidservant, Princess Kachurin, who seemed to have been born in the faded bathing suit she never changed and would die in, no doubt, before reaching majority, or the first really cold winter on the beach mattress which she was moaning on now in her drugged days. And if the child really was called Adora, then what was she? Not Romanian, not Dalmatian, not Sicilian, not Irish, though an echo of brogue could be discerned in her broken but not too foreign English. Was she 11 or 14, almost 15, perhaps? Was it really her birthday, this 21st of July, 1904 or 8, or even several years later on a rocky Mediterranean peninsula? A very distant church clock, never audible except at night, clanged twice and added a quarter. "Smorchiama la secandola," mumbled the bawd on the bed in the local dialect that Vaughn understood better than Italian. The child in his arms stirred and he pulled his opera cloak over her. In the grease-reeking darkness, a faint pattern of moonlight established itself on the stone floor near his forever discarded half-mask lying there and his pump-shod foot. It was not Ardis. It was not the library. It was not even a human room, but merely the squalid recess where the bouncer had slept before going back to his rugby coaching job at a public school somewhere in England. The grand piano in the otherwise bare hall seemed to be playing all by itself, but actually was being rippled by rats in quest of the succulent refuse placed there by the maid, who fancied a bit of music when her cancered womb roused her before dawn with its first familiar stab. The ruinous villa no longer bore any resemblance to Eric's organized dream, but the soft little creature in Vaughn's desperate grasp was Ada.